thanks for coming to the makeup class. We have two more classes remaining after this. Today we'll wrap up the distributed security discussion, and then we have only two topics remaining. We'll have distributed middleware, which spans two chapters in the book. And if we have time in the last class, I'll do a little bit on green computing and pervasive computing. Okay. So we'll continue our discussion from where we left off last time. So we had started a discussion on security. We were talking about encryption, authentication. We looked at different forms of encryption, symmetric, asymmetric, public key cryptography. We also looked at authentication, which is how to prove to someone you are who you are. And we looked at a series of techniques there. And the main takeaway there was using one-time passwords or nonces makes the protocol a lot more secure than using the same password over and over. So with that background, we will spend a little time, a bit of time talking about how some of these principles are used in enterprises, enterprise environments, and distributed applications. So first, just to give the right background, we'll talk a little bit about access control and access control lists. So a lot of, if you remember last time, I talked about authentication, encryption, and then how to authorization, which is how do you ensure that you get access to the right resources. Okay, I said we won't talk a lot about authorization, except to see how typically this is done in practice. So the common technique that is used for authorization is to use access control list. So you keep a list of for an object or a resource. The list specifies which user has access to what kinds of resources or can perform what kinds of operations. So you can use access control lists simply for files, which is actually used in file systems, or volumes, where you specify users and accesses and so on. Okay. You can also use ACLs, as they're called, for distributed objects. When one object tries to perform an operation on another object, the first thing that is checked is, can this object request this operation at all? Only if you have the right privileges are you allowed to do that. Now, this is also used for in enterprise environments where you can specify what employees have what kinds of access privileges, which servers can they access, what printers can they access. Many a times you're restricted to say printers in your floor or your building, but not on other buildings on campus. You can also restrict accesses to various other resources in this fashion. So access control lists are a very common mechanism that are used in a variety of settings to decide who gets access to what. Okay. Now, the other way to do this is what is referred to as capabilities. I don't know if anybody here has heard this term capability. In a technical sense, not just. Okay, so capabilities are another security mechanism which is the opposite of what access control lists are. Think of an access control list as a list that you attach to a resource, and it specifies who can access that resource and what kinds of operations are allowed. Okay? When a user comes in or another process comes in, you basically check against this access control. Capabilities are the opposite. In this case, you attach a list of what operations you can perform to this, think of it as a sender side list. So you give a list to the user saying, here are the exhaustive list of what you can do and cannot do. Okay. So now when you try to access an object or a file or a resource, you specify this list saying, look, I have access, I can access it because it is in my capability list. So capabilities are attached to the entity performing the operation. Access control lists are attached to the capability to the entity on which the operation is being performed. Okay? So they are duals of one another, they're equivalent. Okay? Now most of the systems are tended towards ACLs, but there are many research systems that also focus on capability. So you basically can, if you are a user on a machine, you would get a capability list. So in this case, there are no lists attached to resources. They are attached to users or applications, and when the application has to perform an operation, it has to prove to the system that it has the rights to perform that operation. Okay, so that's a capability model. I won't say much about it. There are papers written on it and so on, but most of the real systems tend to use access control lists rather than going to users. So with that, we'll talk a little bit about security in enterprises. So if you look at a modern environment, okay, whether it's an educational institution, whether it's a company, ensuring the security of all the computing resources is a very complex task, because a distributed system that you see in these environments are also complex. So what is usually done is there's a multi-layered approach to security. There's no one place where you put all the security primitives. They're in a variety of different entities that are spread across the network. So you may have firewalls that are installed next to your main internet router that decides what traffic can enter and what traffic cannot enter, and what ports are open and so on. But that's just one of the many things. You may have other nodes in your network that do what are called deep packet inspection. Firewalls simply look at the headers of packets and decide based on where it came from and where it is going. You will check against a set of rules and say, should you let this packet in or not? Deep packet inspection systems actually look inside the payload itself. That's why it's called deep packet inspection. You not only look at the header, which firewalls do, you actually look inside the packet. And you can do a variety of different things. You can look at, does it have any signature that may resemble a virus that is coming in, as an example. Or you can do deep packet inspection to see whether there are things that are not supposed to be done. Somebody's accessing a file that shouldn't have been accessed, and you can look at the packet and figure out what the contents are. So deep packet inspection systems, there are a variety of them. They perform a variety of different tasks. But what is common is you're not just looking at the packet header, you're looking at the contents of the packet to decide whether it should be allowed to do whatever it's doing, whether should it be forwarded or should it be dropped and blocked. So those are called deep packet inspection systems. Then when you have mail servers, you can have additional systems that are doing virus scans and so on. Every incoming mail, you can check for malware, you can check for viruses, you can also check for junk email and things like that. And then block certain emails and not deliver them to the recipients. That is another layer of security that comes. So these three, try to look at data that is coming in or leaving your network and trying to decide whether that should be allowed or not allowed. Then you have this other set of techniques. So there are things called VLANs, or virtual local area networks, and VPNs, virtual private networks. Together, what they allow you to do is provide secure access to your environment from the outside. Okay, if there are employees or users that want to access resources in your network, typically because there is a firewall policy, you will not be allowed to access machines that are inside the network by default. You will have to use a combination, or typically you use a VPN to provide secure access to the network. So it's the equivalent of dialing in to your network over a secure protocol. It connects you to the network, and now although you are connecting from the outside the enterprise, outside the firewall, you still get access to resources inside. VLANs are virtual local area networks. These are virtual networks that are layered on the physical network that provide isolation. Machines that are on one virtual LAN now cannot see machines that are on another virtual LAN, even though they're physically on the same network. Okay. So basically, if you have to access it, you have to go through a router or that will check some rules. So you can connect two machines on the same Ethernet, but if they're on different virtual networks, they still cannot communicate. Normally, if you're on the same LAN segment, you should be able to send packets to all other machines. VLANs allow you to isolate. So in this case, groups can be isolated from one another for whatever reason that enterprise has. And then there are things that allow you to specify passwords in order to get access to a network. You can have secure versions of wireless networks and so on, which also prevent unauthorized users from accessing it or from intruders from sniffing traffic and so on. So, and then you also have SSL services and security certificates and things like that. So what this is simply telling you, I'm not going to go into the details of each of these boxes. As I said, there's a course on security where this is covered in more detail. All that I wanted to mention here is if you have a distributed system that is on some sort of a LAN or a WAN environment, securing it is not an easy task. Okay, it's not very straightforward because there are all these entities in your network, okay, that you have to deal with. Okay, and you have to make sure that the whatever you intend for this application to happen is reflected in these entities in terms of firewall rules, or it could be based on deep packet inspection systems or some VLANs and so on. So network configuration for security, which directly impacts the security of the distributed system, is a fairly complex task. And because it is this complex, it is often possible that something in your network is misconfigured, and that opens up a hole that you are not intended for to be present, and it allows intruders to get in. This is often what happens, because you may say, to allow VPN access, you will add some firewall rule and allow some outside access. But then after a while, you forget to take that rule out because your firewall itself has a complex set of rules. And then you left something in there, some old rules that shouldn't have been there anymore. And then that causes some problem down the road. Okay, so there are all these complicated factors that come into play when you are trying to secure your network. It's not an easy task. It's something that you should keep in mind. Now, from the perspective of this class, we are only not going to focus on the network elements. We'll see a little bit on SSL and things like that, but this slide shows you from the perspective of the internet service, not the network itself, what are common ways to provide security and authentication. Typical web services will use a combination of SSL to encrypt your communication. The networking traffic is encrypted. It will use some form of authentication, which means you at least minimally have to have some login to the service in order to access that service. Okay. And then you may have other things like captchas that you may have seen that prevent people from writing scripts or bots that go and try to access rather than users. So if you want to limit your service to real users rather than scammers who are simply trying to use automated scripts to access your service, then you have to use even other forms of security. Okay, so those are three common ones. We'll talk a little bit about SSL in the next few slides. Okay. Now, there are other services that use other form of authentication. They don't even assume that you just use a password, a login and a password, okay, because your password can be compromised if it is not chosen in a secure way. Okay, or if you use the same password in many different sites, as many people do, that and in one site is compromised, it compromises other sites as well. So what many services have started doing is what is referred to as multi-factor authentication, that you just don't have just a username and a password, but you have one more form of authentication which typically would not be available to an intruder. Okay, so the simplest one is called two-factor authentication. Okay, you can turn this on if you have Gmail, for instance. In two-factor authentication, what happens is you will have to provide not only a password, but there is also a one-time challenge that is issued to you. Typically, that is sent as a code to your phone that you have to enter. So if you are a user X and you specify your password, the system will send a one-time password to a device, a mobile device, for instance. And then you have to enter that password to prove that you are actually who you claim. And the idea here is, it's assumed that you will know a secret that only you know, and you also have access to a device that only you should have access to, and you use that device to provide additional form of security. You can also get secure keys that are used in enterprises that take the place of a phone. Okay, so you have to use the key as a rotating six-digit PIN that you have to provide to the system to prove that it's actually you, not some other user. Okay. Same thing is true with PayPal, also has this challenge response authentication. So these are all trending towards not just having passwords that are static, but one-time challenge response system. So this is the same idea of having a nonce, which you are never going to repeat. So just because somebody finds a password, you cannot access the system because there is one more layer of authentication. So it's referred to as challenge response authentication, two-factor authentication. Microsoft uses one-time passwords in the same way. Okay, so they are all trying to do the same thing in different ways, which is not to allow passwords, which allow you essentially to replay the password and get into a system. Okay. So now we'll talk a little bit about firewalls and SSLs and so on. So here is a picture of what a firewall looks like. Okay. So this is basically, think of this as machines that are inside the net, machines that are inside the network are on this side, machines that are outside the network are here. There are routers in between. Okay, the firewall is essentially a box that sits between your inside the network and outside the network, and it inspects every packet that goes in and out. There are a set of rules that you put in the firewall that tell the firewall whether to allow each packet or disallow a packet. Okay, by default, if you have allow on everything, all traffic will be allowed to go in and out. But typically, you may say block all traffic on certain ports coming from the outside. So in this case, any traffic that a packet that comes in and it matches that port, it will not be allowed to come in. It will be dropped at the firewall. Okay? You can say do not allow traffic for these machines, okay, regardless of the port. So if a packet comes in for a specific machine and that matches that rule, the packet will be dropped. You can also have what are called allow rules, not just deny rules. Allow rules say allow this to happen rather than disallowing something to happen. So you can say for this machine you should let port 80 traffic come in because that's our web server. It's inside the firewall, but it's our web server, so you should allow port 80 traffic to access that machine. Okay, so you can do things like this using a firewall. And so there are packet filters. So these are what are referred to as packet filtering firewall. They'll simply look at your source address, destination address, source port, destination port, try to match a set of rules and figure out what should or should not be allowed. There are also what are referred to as application specific gateways, which is what is also shown here. These do additional form of access control, but on a per application basis. Okay, so there are application specific code intercepts. So this may, you may have a gateway for a certain kind of application or certain kind of protocol that will allow you to perform certain additional filtering. Okay. And so you not only do packet level filtering, you can do application level filtering. After a rule matches a packet firewall, you can send that packet off to an application gateway, depending on whether that's the right application. Additional processing could be done. Simplest thing to of an application gateway is a virus scanner that I was talking about. Okay, so every packet, many enterprises look at every packet that is coming in and check for the presence of viruses in that packet. Okay, viruses are checked by having what is called a virus signature. Okay, virus signature is a unique string that is present in that virus code, and you look for that string in every packet. Okay, if you find that string, then you say that there is the vulnerability in this packet and you do not let it through. Okay. So that's a simple form of an application level gateway where you have a virus scanner sitting on top of a packet filter. Okay, because a filter is simply saying whether the packet should be allowed or not. It's not looking at what is inside the packet. Is there something malicious inside the packet? Application gateways can check that. They can also do other form of processing, but they can look for malicious data in packets and so on. Okay. They can also perform logging so that you can go back and do auditing later, saying what came in, what went out. You can log all of that information so that if there's a security breach, you go and investigate the logs. Okay. So we'll talk now about SSL and secure email in turn. Okay. So having talked a little bit about the networking elements, let's see how to take some of the ideas we talked about in last class and design secure applications. Okay, the first application is secure email. So what you should realize, first of all, is when you send email, it goes in plain text. Okay, your email is not encrypted. Okay, it's going in plain text, so anyone can look at the contents of the email. Okay, so my email typically is not encrypted, it's going in plain text from your sender to the receiver. If you want to send something that is not vulnerable to eavesdropping, you have to actually encrypt the email. Right? Now keep in mind that encrypting the email is different from having a secure connection between your client, mail client and the mail server. Right? That is simply encrypting the connection between the client and the server. Doesn't mean that your mail is encrypted. Mail is still unencrypted, going in plain text over a secure connection between the client and the server. And then the server is going to send it to the other server over the internet. That's where it's going over plain text. Okay, it may go through multiple mail servers before it reaches the destination. Okay. All of to ensure secrecy of your emails, you have to use some form of an encryption. Okay, and there are, most of the main clients actually support encryption, but it requires additional steps and it is not very easy to use, which is why it has not become very popular. Nevertheless, you can, if you follow these steps, you can actually use mail encryption. Okay, so we'll see how to ensure secrecy, sender authentication, message integrity, and receiver authentication. Okay, so what this means is, first of all, your message will be secret. Okay, no one will be, other than the intended recipient, will be able to read your email. Okay. There will be sender authentication, which means that you can verify that the mail actually came from the sender. It's not a spam where somebody simply inserted your name and sent it off and your friend receives an email that seems to come from you, but you didn't send it. Okay. The mail protocol, SMTP, allows you to insert whatever sender header you want. There is no checks being done there. Okay. So if you want to guarantee or verify that this mail actually came from the sender, you have to use a protocol like this, which will do sender authentication. Message integrity basically says you can verify that the message was not altered in transit. Okay, because it's plain text, somebody can insert whatever text they want in the email. Okay, and then there is nothing to check if the normal mail protocol and the message was not altered. Okay, so you can check that using this protocol. And last is, you want receiver authentication, which is you want to ensure that only the receiver can read it, not someone else. So here's how you will do it. Okay, so first we are going to use public keys. Okay, so this protocol is going to be based on public key cryptography. So you will need, if you want to send, user A, Alice, wants to send an email, secure email to user Bob. Alice needs her private key, which she will have. Alice also need Bob's public key, okay, which is also public. Bob makes the key public. So we'll assume that you have your private key and you have the sender's public key. Okay, so those two things are necessary for this to work. Okay. Simplest thing you can do is you shall just use the recipient's public key and encrypt it. Okay, you want to send a message to Bob, you use Bob's public key, you encrypt the entire email. Now only Bob can decrypt it. But as I said last time, public keys are very long. Okay, encrypting an arbitrary size document or arbitrary size email using public key cryptography is going to be computationally expensive. Okay. Just as when we were looking at digital signatures last time, I said the same thing. So you can simply use a public key to encrypt or sign, or your private key to sign. Same thing is true here. So what we will do is, we will actually generate a smaller symmetric key that will be used to encrypt your email, and you will send the symmetric key securely to the other party. Okay, so then the encryption and decryption of arbitrary size messages is more efficient, because the symmetric key is somewhat smaller than the public key or the private key, which are really long. But then you will still use public and private keys to securely transmit the symmetric key. Okay, so this is basically how it will work. Alice will generate a symmetric key, K. She will encrypt the message M with the symmetric key. So now basically what you have is an encrypted form of a message. And now you have to also send the key with the email. Otherwise the other person who's receiving it doesn't have the key, they won't be able to decrypt it. So what you will do is, you will take the key itself and you will encrypt the key with Bob's public key. So only Bob can extract the key out and then decrypt the message. Is that clear? So you generate a key, you encrypt the email with the key. Since the key has to be sent with the email, you take the key and you encrypt it with Bob's public key. So now only Bob can decrypt this key. Okay. So what you will then send is the encrypted form of the message, which is K of M, and you will send the encrypted key itself, which is encrypted with Bob's public key. Okay, so when Bob receives this message, Bob will use his private key to extract K. And once you have K, you will basically decrypt the message and extract M out of it. Okay, is that clear? So this is basically how you will ensure secrecy. We have only done one of those four steps so far. This is simply encrypting the message. Okay, this doesn't actually allow you to figure out that Alice, there's nothing here that tells you that Alice sent this message. If it says from Alice, okay, in the sending field, there's nothing here that tells you who sent it. Okay, so you can't verify that, and so on. So you'll see how to address these other issues. Okay. So now we'll look at authentication and integrity. So we'll forget about secrecy, which we know how to do, but we'll see how do you do authentication and message integrity. How can you verify that the message was not altered in transit, and how can you ensure that it came from whoever said it came from? Okay. Now this, what we will do is we will use digital signatures. We'll have Alice sign the message. So since Alice is signing the message, in the previous case, Alice was only encrypting the message. Now we will also ask Alice to sign the message. So you can verify that only Alice sent the message. Okay, the way you do this is Alice will first apply hash function H to the message. It could be any hash function, MD5, SHA-hash, or any of those things. Okay. And then you are going to create a digital signature. You will take a hash, the hash of M, and you will encrypt it with your private key. You will sign it with the private key, which essentially means you encrypt the hash with your private key. Okay. And this is how digital signatures work. If you remember last class, I said you can take a string, hash it, you get a fixed size hash, and then you sign it by encrypting it with your private key. Now anyone can verify you signed it because your public key is known. So you can decrypt this hash and extract H of M. And then you can take M and rehash it and compare the two hashes. If the two hashes match, it says that you signed the message. If they don't match, that means that you either didn't sign it or M has been modified in transit. So it has become M prime. So the hash of the modified message will not match H of M. Okay, so it's giving you two things. It's allowing you to verify that somebody signed the message. It also allows you to verify that nobody has altered the message in transit. So in this case, we are simply doing authentication and integrity. You are sending the message unencrypted. M goes unencrypted and you send the signature with the message. Okay, this allows you to verify it came from the right person and it was not modified. Okay, but there is no secrecy here. It's only giving you those two properties because the message itself is going unencrypted. So when people send you, you may have received a message where somebody has signed it with their PGP key. So all that is doing is this, which is it allows you to verify that the email was not modified. Okay, because you send the email unencrypted, but then you can verify that it came from the person because they signed it with their key. It also allows you to verify that nobody modified the message. Okay, but there's no secrecy in this case. Okay, is that clear? So now you can put the two together. Can use the secrecy version from the previous slide and the authentication and integrity from this slide, and then you will have all of those properties. So that's how it will all work here. So first, given the message M, you are going to compute a hash of M. The arbitrary size message becomes a fixed size hash. And you are going to sign the hash with the private key, your private key. Now you get a message M prime, which includes the message itself and the signature. Now we want to also ensure secrecy. To ensure secrecy, you generate a symmetric key K. Okay. And you are going to encrypt this, the message and the signature using K of M. Okay. So you generated a key, you encrypted the message itself and the signature. Okay. So that's think of it as a message with a signature. And then you encrypted the whole thing with this key. And then the key itself has to be sent. So you are going to encrypt the key with Bob's public key. So only Bob can decrypt and extract the key. So now what you are sending is K of M, which is this whole thing, and you are sending the key. So it should be clear that only Bob can make any sense out of it. Because the first thing you need to do in order to read the message is decrypt, get the key. Okay? Only Bob has the private key, so only Bob can get K out of this encrypted version. Okay, so no, the message is useless for anyone else. Okay, now once Bob extracts K, Bob can extract M prime, decrypt this part and extract M prime. Okay? M prime is the original message and the hash, and the signature. So Bob can verify that it came from Alice using the same techniques. Okay? So that is a full-fledged secure mail protocol, okay, where you not only encrypted the message, you signed the message, and you generated a key that you're sending securely, that only the intended recipient can decrypt. Questions on this? So as I said, many mail clients do support it, but people rarely use all of those features. Some people use PGP keys to sign their messages, digitally sign. Yeah, rarely do people decrypt it.
Couldn't this be automated in the sense that normal end users are able to use it with the generation of two keys.
Yes.
Everything else could be automated. So why isn't it being used?
Okay. So question is, can it not be automated? Because you can certainly, so if you generate your own key and you put it into your mail client will start doing this for every email you send out. The reason people don't use it is that the recipient needs to have configured their mail client in order to minimally get your keys. Okay, because to check the signature, etc., you need to get somebody's public key, you need to store it so that every mail can be decrypted automatically. You don't want to send a mail and the other party has to first go around looking for your key and then install the key into your mail client and then your mail client is able to read that email. Okay. So the fundamental assumption is, has the other party taken the necessary steps for them to read my email? Okay, for many people, that is, the answer is no. They don't know how to do that. Okay, you may be savvy enough to generate a key and stick it into your mail client. If you start sending an encrypted email, the other person may say, I can't read your mail. I don't know what to do to read it. Okay? This is the problem. The problem is not whether you can automate it. Once you install a key, your mail client will automatically start doing it. In fact, most mail clients have built-in support for it. If you go and look at security preferences, you will see you can install your key or a certificate to start doing this automatically. Okay. So that is the problem. And it needs to work for arbitrary clients. Some mail clients may not have support for encryption. You are assuming that most modern ones do, but who is to say you are not reading this on Gmail? Okay. Gmail may not provide support because it's a web-based mail client. It's not a full-fledged mail. For example. So these are all the problems that prevent this from being widely used. Otherwise it is, so if you want to send it to a friend and you only want your mail client to send encrypted message to a friend, you can set that up. Okay, you can even set it up saying, when I send to these addresses, encrypt, for these other addresses, do not encrypt. But then you and your friend should have had an agreement that you will use this protocol and both of you install each other's public keys for this to work. Okay. So PGP was designed, which is called pretty good privacy. It's a crypto protocol that has been widely used with emails. It's basically designed to do exactly this. You can generate PGP keys and use this for email clients. Okay. So now we'll talk about, so we saw a good application of everything we had studied last time, authentication, digital signatures, encryption, and so on. So we'll do this now for SSL. Okay. We'll see how HTTPS works in the same way. When you set up, when your browser sets up an HTTPS connection to the web server, what are all the steps that are actually happening under the hood? Okay. SSL was a protocol that was designed a long time ago by the predecessor of Firefox, which was Netscape. It was the original popular web browser. So what they wanted was a secure way for a browser to communicate with a server. Just as I said, when you send an email, by default it goes unencrypted. Same is true when you set up a connection to a web server. Normal HTTP requests and responses are unencrypted. If you look inside the packet, you'll see the contents of the document that's being sent to you. So if you're doing bank transactions or things like that, you don't want that to be the case. You don't want whatever the contents of the page the bank is sending you to be visible to someone else. Okay. So you want that connection to be encrypted. Okay. So what secure sockets are is, think of it as a security layer that is layered on top of a socket. A socket simply provides a connection between a client and a server, or any two machines for that matter, and sends packets. The packets are not encrypted. So what you can do is put a layer on top so that every packet you send is encrypted, sent over a normal socket, it comes out at the other end. The layer is at the other end as well. It decrypts it and hands it back to the application. Okay. So in this case, the application doesn't have to do encryption, neither do the sockets. There's a layer that sits in between the application and the socket interface that is taking anything you're sending and encrypting. This is like telling your mail client, they start encrypting everything. Same thing, you're telling your socket or the library that sits on top of socket, saying encrypt anything I send. I don't want to deal with it. You set up everything and then I just give you a packet, you encrypt, you send it, and decrypt it at the other end. Okay? Unlike secure email, HTTPS is widely used. Okay? Clearly, all of these financial transactions and all everything that you do with any website that has sensitive data actually uses this. Okay? It is also used Now, in other contexts, so if you use IMAP to access your email, by default it goes over SSL, it's encrypted. A lot of network communication is encrypted simply because this is using the same socket abstraction, it has simply started encrypting it. So all you need to tell your application is, rather than using unencrypted socket, use an encrypted version of the socket, and you're still doing send and receive the way you do it with normal sockets. So it is very easy to take any two applications that are communicating over plain sockets and just have them use secure socket instead and encrypt all of their communication. Okay? So it's used in a variety of protocols. IMAP uses SSL. Lots of other applications basically use secure version. Anything that requires network communication, you can secure with SSL. Okay? Now we'll see how SSL itself works. We'll look at a specific set of interaction between a browser and the server. Okay? So let's say you use HTTPS instead of HTTP. Okay? What HTTPS tells your browser is, this is an HTTP request, but please use secure sockets. Encrypt everything. To do that, you have to first set up a secure session between the client and the server. That's not just a TCP connection, but you, in addition to that, you set up a session and a session key and so on, as is shown here. Okay, so first the browser is going to tell the server, saying, I support this SSL version and these are some preferences I have. Because there are the version 1 and now there's version 2 and so on. So you have to say, I want to use SSL and this is the SSL version and I can support. The server is going to reply back, saying, okay, I will use this version. Hopefully it's the same version that the client wants to use, and it will provide a certificate. Okay. Certificate is what I had said last time. Certificate is a digitally signed piece of information that a secure third party has provided to the server, so that the server can prove its identity to you. Okay. It also includes the server's public key. So it's in order for you to know you are actually talking to your bank server, not some machine that is masquerading as your bank server. You tell the server, prove to me before I start sending you an encrypted packet that this is actually you, okay, the bank site. Okay? The way the server is going to prove it to you is provide a certificate. Certificate is this, as I said, is signed by a third party. It includes the name of the server, it includes the public key of the server. Okay? And it, the whole or both of those things are encrypted by this trusted third party's private key. Right? Most of the browsers, and these are called certification authorities or CAs, right? Most browsers are built in with the public key of the certification authority. So you can decrypt the certificate automatically and extract its contents. Right? And in the content, you will see this certificate belongs to this machine. Okay? It also tells you about, it also has information about the public key of the server, for instance. Okay, so now you have extracted the public key. Okay? This is a secure way of getting the public key because you cannot switch the public key. Okay? Some intruder cannot send somebody else's public key in place of the server's public key because that would have to be signed by the certification authority. And then the certification authority wouldn't issue a public key to a random person saying, you are Bank of America. Okay? If you did that, then there will be all sorts of problems. And we can just show up with the server and claim to be a bank. Okay? So the assumption is that there is some verification that happens before the certification authority issues a certificate. It verifies your identity, that you're actually in this bank or you're an employee of this bank, so I give this only to you, not to some random person who makes a request. Okay? So that's how certification authorities work, which is why there's a built-in trust between the browser and whatever the certification authority has certified. Okay, so you basically, so once you have verified this, you now have the server's public key. It has come to you as part of the certificate. You also verified the identity of the server. Okay. So now what you can do is the browser will say, it will generate a session key K and it will encrypt it with the public key that came, the server's public key that came with the certificate. Okay, so you generate a key. That's the key you're going to use for the encryption of your socket. Okay, and then the browser is going to say that all future messages will be encrypted and it will basically send a nonce. Okay, so you send that nonce and the key, and then the server will also basically do the same thing and send the nonce back, and the SSL session is going to begin. Okay. So the whole process, bootstrapping process, involves getting the server's public key, which comes to you as part of the certificate that the server will send to you. It involves generating a session key and securely sending the session key, encrypting the session key using the public key that came to you. You send it off, only the server can extract that key. And then you have a message exchange saying, let's encrypt future messages. And then this protocol will switch to secure message. So all of the remaining messages will now get encrypted with the key K for the duration of the session. Okay. Now the application, all of this is transparent to the application. Okay. This is actually handled by the SSL library, which just provides a socket abstraction to your application. The application is simply saying send and receive. And then all of this is actually being done, although it says the browser is the SSL library in the browser that simply provides a socket abstraction. Okay? Any questions here? Okay, so last application we'll look at before looking at other kinds of applications. Last distributed systems or networking application we're going to look at is Kerberos. Okay, Kerberos is also another widely used authentication and encryption protocol that is used in many network environments. Okay, it provides what is called a single sign-on service. Okay. So what single sign-on says is you basically authenticate once with a main authentication server, and you are going to be given some sort of a handle, and from that point on you can access any of the resources that are in the trust environment of this entity. So you don't have to provide any passwords anymore. Otherwise what happens is your password may be the same on multiple machines, but every time I have to log into yet another machine, I have to re-authenticate with that machine. Okay. If all of this is part of the same network environment, the Kerberos philosophy is you authenticate once. Once you're authenticated, we know who you are. We'll also give you keys so you can do everything securely. Then you access all these network services without having to re-authenticate. You can just simply provide some sort of a handle that says, I've authenticated, so I'm done. Not going to re-authenticate. So Kerberos is not used here in this environment, but many other environments use Kerberos to do this, to prevent you from repeatedly providing your password to the same set of services. They use the same password across services. Okay, so it's providing the single sign-on type scenario. Okay, here is basically how it's going to work. So let's say Alice wants to log into a workstation. Okay. So basically Alice will say login, and what will happen is at this point her username is sent to what is called a Kerberos authentication service. The Kerberos authentication service is basically going to give you a variety of things. So in Kerberos, there are two things. There's authentication server and there's something called a ticket granting service. Right? Ticket granting service allows you to access any, once you're authenticated, you can ask for a ticket to access a new service. Okay, you get a ticket, you show up with a ticket saying, look, I'm already authenticated, here is my ticket, let me in. Okay, so you don't have to repeatedly give your password. Okay, so first time you log in, you do provide your identity, and then what comes back from the authentication server is a key. That only you and that you can talk to the ticket granting service, and then it's going to basically encrypt, provide an encrypted version that allows the authentication server to tell the ticket server, say, I have authenticated Alice. Okay, so this is a key that only the AS and the ticket granting service knows. It has Alice's name in there, saying, I have already authenticated Alice. So this comes back to you, in this case, it comes back to the workstation. So the workstation goes to the ticket granting service saying, authentication is done, please give me a ticket so that this user can access the service. Okay? So you basically send this part over, there's a nonce, and then you basically send this off to the ticket granting service. And the ticket granting service essentially is going to provide a reply saying, here, let the user in. Okay? Now every time you have to access a new system, you're simply going to go back to the ticket granting service with that and then provide this credential saying let me, okay? And the ticket could be the tickets have a lifetime. Okay, this is not a lifetime access to get and get into any machine you want. You can give 30-minute tickets or 6-hour tickets. So at the end of this, the ticket granting service is going to say you are done. At this point, you have to re-authenticate for me to allow you to access any more servers. Okay? So based on the system administrator's preferences, this authentication single sign-on is valid for a certain amount of time. Okay. Once that time expires, then you have to re-authenticate. Okay. So this allows you to sign on once And then let's say you give an 8-hour ticket, so come in the morning. So for the duration of the day until evening, you don't have to provide your login again. But after that, the ticket expires. Next day when you come in, if you try to show this to the ticket granting service, it'll say expired, re-authenticate. So you go and re-authenticate. So that's the Kerberos environment. Now, this notion of single sign-on is present in many different scenarios where you provide one-time password and then it will allow you to access multiple services without re-entering your password. And so, but this is how it is done in the Unix environment. Okay, so it's been around for many, many years based on this principle. Any questions on this? Okay. So last thing we'll look at is electronic payments and how you can use security as a, or security principles to provide secure payments. Okay, so before we do electronic payments, here's a little bit of an overview of how payments work today or how they work for a very long time. Okay, so there are many ways to make payments. You can write, you can use cash, you can use a check, you can use a credit card to make any sort of a payment to a merchant. And this is basically how it is going to work. So if you are using cash, it is very clear how you do this. You go to your bank, you withdraw some money, you make a payment to the payee. Okay, that's a cash transaction. The payee is going to either spend it or deposit it as bank. And that's the way it works. Okay, now the good thing about cash payments, okay, there are many bad things in that. If your money is stolen, you can't get it back and so on. But the good thing is it's anonymous. To make a cash payment, to walk into a store and make a cash payment, based on the payment, they cannot figure out who you are. Okay? So that is not present in many other forms of payment. So let's say you do this for the check, not as anonymous. So what happens is your bank issues you a check book. Okay, you write a check, give it to the paying merchant. Merchant will cash the check. Okay? The way the cashing process works is you go deposit the check to your bank or the merchant's bank. And the merchant's bank and the payee's bank will run a protocol whereby the payee's bank will send the check to the your bank saying this person wrote a check. Your bank is going to verify your signature and then take the money from your account and give it to the payee's bank. Okay, so that's called a check clearing process or a settlement process. Okay. Now this is less anonymous because the check has your name and you can figure out who the person is from somewhere. It's not as anonymous as cash payments. Okay. Now credit card payments work the same way as check payments, except that they're all electronic, there's no paper involved. Okay. So your bank or a credit card company issues you a credit card. Okay. Then when you when you want to make a payment, you use the card to go to a merchant and make a payment. They typically use a terminal to take your information and then validate it. Okay. So what that happens is, so that's a credit card transaction that goes to the payee's bank. Okay, which has issued the terminal saying, here's a credit card, okay, and this is the amount of money that has been charged to it, get me the money. Okay. So what the payee's bank will do on this is basically it will again run a settlement process. Typically there's an intermediary in the settlement process, a payment system like Visa or MasterCard, which is not shown here. Says I'm saying that the banks actually talk to one another. They typically talk to an intermediary, that is the one that is running the payment service, but that's not shown for convenience. So the payee's bank is going to say, this is an order or a credit card order, here's the amount, transfer the money. Right? The bank or your card company is going to transfer the money and then you get a bill at the end of the month, so you can pay the credit card. Okay? Same process as a check, but involves a settlement process. Yeah, then again, the issue here is it is not anonymous. It is more convenient, okay, even more convenient than cash, because if the credit card companies don't ensure that you have no liability if somebody steals your card and things like that, which you don't get with cash. Okay. But you have lost anonymity in the process. Okay? So now there is a protocol called e-cash, where people try to say, why not have some of the advantages of cash but make it electronic? The predecessor to modern payment systems like Bitcoin and PayPal and so on, this never actually got implemented, but this was designed and had some nice properties which is worth looking at. Okay. So the way you can actually use e-cash is the payer in this case will generate a coin, okay, with a certain amount of it. So you say basically your $10 coin. Okay. Now then what you tell the bank is sign this coin so that it can be validated that it's real money, not fake money, and blind it. Meaning the coin may have a serial number, okay, so but you don't want anything to be shown to the merchant, so just blind the coin, so it's, you can't trace it back. Okay. So the bank is going to sign the blinded coin. So the best analogy to think of this is you have a let's say you have a $10 bill, actual cash bill, you put it in an envelope so that nobody can trace the serial number or anything like that, and you ask the bank saying stamp or sign this envelope saying it has $10. So if you give this envelope to somebody, they will actually see the bank signature saying there is real money in it, it's not fake money. But then what is in there cannot be traced back to you because you can't see the serial number or anything like that. Same is true here. The blinding process involves putting this coin, which is an electronic record, into an envelope and signing it so that the other party can verify that this is real money and verify that the bank has actually signed. Okay. So now you get a blinded coin and then you can make that send that coin over to the receiver. Okay. That's a payment. And the receiver is going to go to the bank and say, is this real money? Okay. It's like the just as you validate a credit card, you go run a validation process. The bank will say, yes, we signed it. It is actually $10. Okay. So the receiver will take payment and then they can go and actually get the money in lieu of the coin. Okay. So this is called e-cash. Okay. The reason this whole protocol was developed was electronic. It was supposed to be an electronic version of actual cash. With the same kind of properties that you could pretty much walk in and give this coin, which is an electronic thing, to some merchant. They can verify that it is my real money. And so, and there are some interesting properties that you need to, which I did not mention here, which are in the protocol. So you can't do double spending, for instance, because electronic coin at the end of the day is a simple file that you get. Okay, it's a digital file that you can go and give to someone. Okay? Now you have to prevent double spending, which is why the bank is going to actually, when they sign it, they can figure out if you have spent it. But what is to prevent you from giving this file to two people and both are going to go and say, okay, it's $10. So you want double spending to be shouldn't happen, which is why you need to validate it and the bank can figure out, has it already been cashed before? Okay, so if somebody has already cashed this $10 e-coin, then you shouldn't let a new merchant say yes to them. You can say, no, this is not a valid coin. It has already been used. So that's basically a way to do it in this case. Okay. Now clearly this did not go anywhere. You can't go and see e-cash anywhere, but the book has a full protocol that tells you how to go about doing this. Okay. What merchants do is instead of doing all this, they give you gift cards which are equivalent. Okay. They're anonymous. You can buy a gift card with cash. And then you can use the gift card as electronic money. You can show up and give the gift card. It cannot be traced back to you if you purchase it with cash, for instance. Okay. And then they will check that the money has not been spent. They will run this protocol without having a bank. They are acting as the clearinghouse. They check with their system saying, has the money been spent and so on. Okay. So I have just one quick slide on Bitcoin. I won't go into the details of the protocol in the class here, but since this has become a very popular way of using electronic money of some sort, I thought I'll just say a little bit about it. Okay, so it's a form of a digital currency. It is actually uses a peer-to-peer model. So you can think of it as a P2P version of electronic cash. Okay. It uses an open source cryptographic protocol to actually implement all the payment system. Okay, so completely open source, so you can see how the protocol works and so on. And the way this works is there is the notion of the coins being made by Bitcoin servers, and there's a certain rate at which these coins are being generated. The protocol itself controls the rate at which the coins get generated. It actually drops over time and so on. And what is at the heart of this is it actually uses public keys to pay and track payments. So as far as I know, it is not as anonymous as, let's say, the way e-cash was generated. There's a way to go back and track who actually made payments to whom and so on and so forth. But it is electronic. It is not controlled by any one entity, okay, which is what people like about it. It's not money that's either issued by a like a federal bank that belongs to a country or a merchant. Okay. The prepaid card thing, the merchant is issuing the electronic cash. No? And real cash is issued by countries, reserve banks. Neither of those are 2 years, not controlled by anyone. So people like it, saying that this is completely decentralized and so on. So it has become popular. Some merchants now accept bitcoins and so on. Unfortunately, also used a lot of illegal activities, because people who really don't want to be tracked are people who are not doing the right things sometimes. So that's how it became popular. But hopefully the properties there would appeal to much broader base, and either Bitcoin or some variant of it will actually become popular. E-cash hasn't gone anywhere. People think that this is the way things will be done in the future for electronic payments using secure protocols. So that's all I'm going to say about Bitcoin here. I won't go into the details of the protocols. Okay, so if there are no questions, I'm going to switch gears and go to the next topic. Okay, let me just pause here. Are there any questions on any aspect of security? We covered encryption, authentication, signatures. We saw a list of different applications that use them. Okay. So, next topic is distributed middleware. Here we are going to look at a variety of different systems that provide middleware services. But very early on, I said towards the end of the class, we'll come back and look at this middleware platform that provide higher level services to end applications. So the idea is you are writing a distributed application. Okay. Many distributed applications have the same set of concerns. Okay. How do you use locking? How do you use consistency? How do you use security? Rather than writing code to do this over and over again, why not have a middleware platform that implements these common services or libraries that you can simply use rather than redoing it or writing code from scratch for every application? That is the motivation behind middleware. We'll see several. Okay. We'll look at Enterprise, Java Beans, EJBs, we'll look at Corba, we're going to look at DCOM, which is Microsoft's middleware, and now it's called .NET. Okay. And we are going to look at G, which is Java version of middleware. They all have slightly different semantics, and they do roughly similar things except for GD, but there are some important differences. Okay. Most of these are object-oriented. They use this version notion of a distributed object. Back when we did RPCs or RMIs, I talked about remote objects. Remote objects are objects that live on a different machine. Okay? You can access methods on that object from another machine, not from the same process. Okay? Distributed objects generalize the notion of a remote objects. Okay? So they distributed objects clearly are objects that could be remote. But the object itself may be distributed across multiple machines. It could be replicated across multiple machines. So you can think of an object which is some data and some methods on it. Okay. The object is distributed. Some of the data may reside on some machine. Some other data may reside on another machine. Some of the code may be on one machine and some may be on another machine. Or the object could be replicated. The same code and the same data reside on multiple machines. You can go to any instance of the object to access the method. Okay. Lot of the middleware systems are going to use this notion, okay, to implement some services. Okay. So the default case is you just have a single remote object that you can access over a network. The most next evolution is the object is replicated. The object being completely distributed is the most complex case. Okay. So what this is showing you is a simple RMI happening between a client and the server, same picture that I put up in lecture 3 or lecture 4. So you have a client that has a proxy, which is the stub. You make a request, okay, the proxy is going to send that over the network. The stub at the other end is called the skeleton. That box is the object. The gray thing is the state of the object, which is all the variables that are private to the object. And these other small boxes are methods. There's code that you can invoke on the object to access its state. That's something you should keep in mind. We'll see different instantiations of this distributed objects in different middleware systems. So we have already looked at the notion of how the remote, so the same is true of distributed objects. So you have remote methods or remote objects. Okay. And then here are some important issues that come up when you have large scale distributed objects. So you have to create an object and you have to register it. The question is, who do you register it with? Okay. It has to be a naming service that is well known to the client. Otherwise, if the client goes to look for this object, saying, where is the machine that store has this object code and state? Okay, the naming service itself needs to be well known to the client. Otherwise, if you register it with something that the client doesn't know about, the client cannot discover where the object is. Okay. Important issue in a distributed application. The naming service may be itself running on a third machine, but the client needs to know where to go. It won't be local to go. Then you have the client side, you have to get the object reference. In order to dereference a remote object, you have to first get its reference. Okay. Either that could be passed to you as a parameter, or you may be able to go and look that. And then you have to invoke the object as we will see, a method on the object as we will see. Okay. So before we go into some of these systems, this chart is actually showing you how these systems have evolved over time. Okay. At the very beginning, we had simply had RPCs. Okay. And then there was the very first middleware that was built, I think, in the 90s, was this environment called DCE, Distributed Computing Environment. Okay. It allowed you to take these objects and build all these fancy services on top. It was very complicated. Okay. It was not used much at all and failed eventually. Never went anywhere. But that was the very first attempt to take RPCs and build a middleware that was RPC based, so you could easily write distributed applications. Okay, out of the DCE effort, several other middleware systems grew. Okay. Microsoft took those ideas and created PROM and DCOM, okay, which is their version of middleware. The name keeps changing. Okay. DCOM has now become .NET, okay, but same principle. Okay. The Unix world went and designed Corba. Okay, that was in the Windows world, in the Unix world, and sort of the next evolution of a distributed middleware was Corba, Common Object Request Broker Interface. We'll talk about Corba, hopefully we will do it next time. Okay. Corba was also far too complicated, didn't go very far. Okay, some applications were built using Corba, but it was too complicated. The problem is you build a complicated middleware. It becomes slow, it becomes clunky, and you have to read 10 manuals in order to write a very simple application. Nobody wants to use it. Okay, you programmers want to write quickly. Okay. In making the putting too much into the middleware, the learning curve for the learning the middleware is higher than writing an application from scratch. Okay. Doesn't make sense. So those kinds of systems users, at least developers, don't want to use. Okay, so Corba was also a little too heavyweight. So although it is still used in some specific context, it did not become very popular. Okay. We will talk about Corba. One common application that actually uses a very stripped down version of Corba is GNOME. Okay. If you use the Linux machine, the X interface on it is either typically KDE or GNOME. Okay. GNOME is actually built on using Corba abstractions. That's about the one that most people have at least heard of or used. Most of the other ones you probably don't use at all. Okay, and then what came out of that, which is actually still widely used, is this RPC notion was implemented in Java, so you have Java RMI. And then they built this middleware using Java that are called EJBs, Enterprise Java Beans. Okay. EJBs are also actually widely used for all sorts of server-side applications. Any multi-tier application, if it is actually built in companies, they prefer to use Java. Okay. Open source people like to use Python or PHP and other things. Okay. So that's the app server is written using EJBs in many enterprise applications. So banking application, anytime you have an online bank, most likely that online banking site is written in EJB. Not always, but very likely. Okay. So that's the history of how these middleware systems have come about. And here is basically what has happened. Many of these early middleware were designed with this kind of vision in mind. So there will be all these objects and they're running on all these machines, they will all talk to one another and build some grand application on top. And they were designed with that idea in mind. right? Which is why they were very complex, because you can have very complicated interactions. What typically most applications do is two client server. Okay? There's one entity at the client, one entity at the server, they are the ones talking to one another. And the realization